I'm trying to deliver images for you so that you can follow this and recognize the significance of what we're dealing with here. Look here once. Bronze. If you're wearing a bronze helmet, carrying bronze weapons, bronze shield, you're riding in a chariot with bronze ornament, the sun glints off you, you are grand. The Bronze Age is an age of unbridled masculine chutzpah. The Bronze Age warrior was a glamour boy with power and had life and death in his decision. Just before Euripides' time comes the discovery that if you make a spear out of dirty old iron, it'll go completely through that bright bronze sheen and through the bright smile and kill the bastard. Can you understand what a blunt blow that is to the pride of a defeat civilization to have this dirty piece of iron thrown by some soldier that you can't do anything about? It's like a threshold of a whole different technology, which at first seems crummy. How can this idiot throwing this dirty piece of metal and we can't do anything about it? Our civilization is doomed. The Bronze Age, when it was penetrated, burst like a bubble. And when it burst, it produced a dark age. It was a dark age in Greece. There's that kind of equality that's going on here. Out of the vacuum of the dark age comes a need to have some new way to put yourself together again. And out of that need is a need to incorporate the dirty underground, the simple iron. The Dionysian new religion is this kind of equality coming in. It's just what you rejected before, it's just what you need now. So there's a paradox involved. The new, accepting the new conditions of life, involves a paradox. One has to work in what one had rejected before. What one had a resistance to before, the resistance must be transformed now into an acceptance. But anytime the pendulum swings like that, the psychological tendency is that with all the violence that you resisted, you now with violence accept it. You cling to it. And you get the same problem, only inside out. Instead of wasting all your time resisting the religion, you waste all your time trying to grasp every bit of it. Notice that the key here is balance. And the Greek wise saying is moderation in everything. Moderation in everything. And out of this comes an appreciation for proportion. Notice the genius of Pythagoras. I'm doing a Thursday nights at the PRS in Pythagoras. Notice the genius of Pythagoras to say that universal integration is a harmony of all the proportions in the right sequencing together. Incredible genius. Going right to the core of the problem. Grasping it with high consciousness and with devoted application. Notice that by Euripides' time, even the Pythagorean genius had been rejected, had been allowed to die out. Notice the quandary. Notice the situation. So that the Delphic inscription shows that the Dionysos of the Palace of Cadmos was connected with the Trieretic cult. Trieteric cult. And we'll get to this in a moment. The inscription does not mention the sacred feast days of the Theban women, which form the basis of the story of resistance, but only public festive gatherings with dramatic performances. What were these public festive gatherings with dramatic performances? It was the beginnings of Greek tragedy. so that the tragedy, the great tragedy of Bacchae, is a conscious reflection back, in a way, on the very origins of the form Greek tragedy, of which this was an example. It was a recursive movement of consciousness to go back and try to understand what was the form of this expression that we're using right at this very moment. Notice the valiant attempt of Euripides to pull it off. Grand style. Euripides is grand. He's not a... Usually we get the impression from academics that, oh, well, Aeschylus is the best and Sophocles is very close, and then Euripides is way down, third best, way down at the end. It's not so at all. We have twice as many plays, twice as many tragedies of Euripides saved. Why? Twice as many as both Aeschylus and Sophocles together. Why? Because Euripides looks at the problem, and though he is screaming mightily, he is unflinchingly still looking at the very problem. The problem that broke the whole form. There never were good Greek tragedies after this. You know what was written after this? The Romans began writing comedies, like Plautus and Terence. And so Roman comedy, sitcoms, Roman sitcoms came in place of this, because no one could do this anymore. Friends, there is not a great Greek tragedy until the time of Seneca, and even then, in the first century AD, 500 years after Euripides, Seneca's tragedies are not anywhere near the Greek tragedies. Seneca's tragedies are like French court tragedies. Seneca was in the time of Nero. The next time that you have a tragic play which comes up to the conscious part of the Bacchae is Shakespeare's Hamlet, 2,000 years later. So you can see what an enormous achievement this was, and what a tremendous letdown there was in terms of civilized consciousness to not even be able to come back up to that level for a couple thousand years. I say this again, not to even come up to that level of consciousness again for a couple thousand years. We think the Dark Ages were like in the 400s, 500s, 600s. There never again was the fineness of consciousness in that expressive form until the mind of Shakespeare in the high Renaissance in England. And incidentally, I've lectured on this years ago, and the complement to Shakespeare in England is Cervantes in Spain. And Cervantes, like Shakespeare, very, very great insight into the tragic nature of consciousness in the form in which we have it. And Don Quixote and Hamlet belong together in the same stage of life. They're great protagonists who bring out the essential quality that what we're dealing with here is we're dealing with trying to learn how to accept the potentially unreal as a facet of our dynamic real. And paradoxical though that may sound, it must be done. We must be able to include that to ourselves. Now, the Spanish were much better than the English were at understanding this, and if you want to follow up some of the Spanish genius in this, the writings of Don Miguel Unamuno, in the early 20th century are appropriate to this. He wrote a whole series of essays that on Don Quixote that are collected in a Bullingen volume, Our Lord Don Quixote. And he also wrote a book called The Tragic Sense of Life, which is all about this poignancy. And he wrote, in fact, exemplary novels on the style of Cervantes. I think three exemplary novels are published by Grove Press in paperback still, by Don Miguel de Unamuno. And you find all kinds of qualities in here. Towards the end of the exemplary novels, the characters come into the study of Unamuno and the characters petition Unamuno to write more stories about them, because since he has created them, he has a responsibility for their existential health. They must have more stories to live in. It's this kind of a quality of consciousness that you must weave in the potentially unreal into your sense of reality, like this fly. I have to work this fly in. I don't have the pleasure of squashing it. And so my hand gestures have to be convincing to you at the same time of trying to nab it, you see. That's consciousness. It may not seem very high, but it really is. Notice here that one of the qualities of the quandary has to do with the relationship between men and women. The essential relationship between men and women. That if there is not a kind of a sync between them, then there is a kind of an out-of-stepness which characterizes the unreality of it all. Characterizes the resistance. And the resistance becomes projected very easily on the opposite sex. I'd be all right if men didn't do this to me. We would be all right if men weren't this way. Or, the other side, we'd be all right if women didn't do this. If women weren't that way, we'd be all right. If only I could find the right man. Well, if only I could find the right woman. Whereas the problem is not in that mode at all. The problem is with ourselves. The problem is with ourselves. There's only one point in the focus, you see. It's with ourselves. And so the projected blamingness of others, regardless of how sophisticated it seems, is to fall and be enclosed in the mythos, enclosed in the feeling of it, and not be able to deal with it in any effective way that could solve it. Only by engendering purposiveness in a conscious activity can one get out of the bind which by now that mythos has engendered. The conscious characteristic of an all-embracing mythology, which is for sure nurtured one, for sure protected one, but now you have to come out of, the conscious style of that is that that's the Orphic egg out of which you must be born. The purpose of the realization that that's a cosmogonic egg is to get born out of it. Not to be a happy yolk in it under whatever conditions, but to come out of it. And so the Orphic egg has wrapped around it all the time the world serpent. Indeed it does. Not the world serpent that swallows the egg, but the world serpent wrapped around it. You have to be born out of that. Eventually that serpent will swallow that egg. It is a primordial human image expression of this quandary. Even the early American Indians along southern Ohio, you see the great serpent mound around Marietta, Ohio, 1,300 feet long, the serpent and then the egg there. It's a universal theme. It comes up in human nature regardless. So Carinyi is writing here, the mystery character of the women's ceremonies. And in the Bacchae, you have the women's ceremonies have a mystery character. Not detective mystery, but mystery in like underground, subconscious, mythic eeriness, paradoxical rituals, like that kind of a quality. Carinyi writes, the mystery character of the women's ceremonies, the true triateric rites, is shown by the fact that the public was offered dramas in Thebes and wine miracles in Elias. This was not so at the start, however. The need for dramas and miracles arose in a later day. You either do it through drama, through the dramatic interchange, or you go back into a mythic presentation, which is miraculous. The need for miracles discloses the incapacity for dramatization of it. If you can't talk it out, then hopefully something magical is going to happen. Hopefully some miracle is going to happen and get you out of it. You're going to win the lottery. It's a gambling kind of a thing. Instead of doing it the old-fashioned way, earning it, you're going to hit the right number. It's a miracle is going to happen, going to save you. Whereas consciousness has to dramatize it, has to work it out in order to be born out of that, in order to be freed out of that. The inner logic, writes Karenyi, the inner logic of the two-year period, and notice that we're involved in a two-year cycle ourselves here. I've told you without lie consistently, this is ancient wisdom tradition brought up to date. This is consistent with the wisdom tradition all the way through. It's just a 21st century style of it. The inner logic of the two-year period, a living dialectic corresponding to the building, destruction, and rebuilding of life. The building, destruction, and rebuilding of life. The birth, the death, the rebirth. Operated in secret. The two-year cycle was secret. Not so much secret, just subconscious at this time. Literally, subconscious. Its continuous realization in the triateric cult may be taken as demonstrated from the Mycenaean, indeed from the Minoan period on. Despite the secrecy, its meaning is made clear by precise indications. And then he has on page 198, I'll just give you one little paragraph here, headlined, The Dialectic of the Two-Year Period. And notice now, we're doing exactly here what Euripides did in his time. Euripides is writing a Greek tragedy using the purpose of the Greek tragedy to reflect back on the very origins of the form engendered Greek tragedy. We're using a two-year cycle now at this point to look back upon the very origins of the two-year cycle as a structure of engendering wholeness and consciousness. I'm not as polished as Euripides, but it works just as well, I must say. He writes, in the second year of a triaturus, the opposite happened of what had happened the first year. It was not until the third year that repetition set in. That's why the tri, the three. So even though it's a two-year cycle, one doesn't realize until one has gone through the cycle. One doesn't realize until the third year what has happened. So that the basic form is a structure of conscious realization in threes. The first form is to establish a movement. The second form is to establish a counter movement. And the third form is to establish what was called a stand, or the Greek word for it was epod, a realization. And that three-part sequence was the core of the sacred dance movement. One circled around to the right, then one circled around to the left, and then one came to a stand. The form of that movement is the very structure of classical Greek literature in its highest religious sense. For instance, the lyrical poetry of the Odes of Pindar is based on that very structure. The invention of lyric poetry is based on that very structure. the chorus parts of a Greek tragedy are all based on that structure. Every time the chorus comes into play in a Greek tragedy, it's in that structure. Like the Greek words for it with the strophe, the antistrophe, and the epode. And one could make variations on that. In fact, Euripides, because this is the last great Greek tragedy, is very sophisticated. He sometimes will have a strophe and an antistrophe, then another strophe, then another antistrophe, and then an epode. Or sometimes he'll work refrains in a strophe, a refrain, an antistrophe, a refrain, and then an epode. Or once in the Bacchae, because he's trying to show that consciousness breaks, he has a strophe and an antistrophe and no epode. And it discloses right there in the form. Not in what is said, not in the content, but in the very form. If one's following the form, it's like a musical form that abruptly ends before it's completed. It's like there's no coda, and one is left hanging. One realizes something has happened. What has happened? Not able to complete the movement. Now, if you did it in dance, it would mean that you would spin to the right and you would spin to the left, but you never stopped. The very image of madness. You can't stop. You can't continue and you can't stop. Now, just to save you from horrible hot afternoon depressions, human spiritual genius is titanic in addressing itself to these kinds of situations. Now, a genius named Rumi showed that you can have a stand presence even while still moving. You can put the presence inside an eternal movement. So don't let past madnesses of mankind bother you. The genius of mankind has always met the challenge and has always come through. We wouldn't be here if it hadn't. Our ancestors would have gone crazy long since. In a way, this is the comic theory of life, that man makes increasingly more difficult problems for him because he increasingly has more capacity and he doesn't want to get bored. So if you have spaceship capacities to go to other planets, you make a cold war that threatens this planet. You give yourself enough problems so that you can really have something to hone in on. It's the little dog theory that as long as you're a puppy, you need to chew on something, and so you make problems good enough so that you have something to exercise your teeth on. When you grow up, then you don't make those problems for yourself because your teeth are already grown. Something like that. It's the comic theory of life. French Farces by Georges Feydeau specialize in this outlook on life. Just when it seems that everything is completely messed up, everything falls together in a most miraculous way. So it can happen that way. So in this two-year period, the second year is antithetical, is opposite to the first year. But its antitheticality is necessary for completeness. It's like what we do in the first year of this program leads towards integration, and everything we do in the second year leads towards differentiation. At the end of the first year, we want it to come together in some symbolic way. We can say, this is it. But at the end of the second year, we want it to be spreading out as far as it can go, and the last time we saw it was still spreading. That's the nature of life, the nature of reality. The first movement produced the child, but when the child was born, the last time we saw it, we want it to be doing as much as it can in its own life and going wherever it wants to go. It comes together to be born, but when it is born, it goes out and widens up. So the future that we want to hear about is the last time we saw human beings, they were going wherever they were going to go, wherever they wanted to go, doing whatever they saw fit to do, and doing it with great integrity and high style. The happy ending is not that they lived happily ever after, everybody with two Porsches and five bedrooms. That would be a horrible hell. Because that would condemn us all to that kind of static opulence which leads nowhere, which is just a projection of some mythic image base which is leading towards something else anyway, interiorization, mysterious focusing within. The purpose of Sinbad's voyages is not to get wealthy, but to have the adventures. What's valuable afterwards is not that Sinbad is rich, but that he's going through all those adventures he understands. And after the seventh voyage of Sinbad, he stops counting. He doesn't need to count. He can go wherever he wants to go. He's free. He's gone through the seven levels. He's in the eighth sphere of the openness of the cosmos. He no longer is lured by the gems, lured by the gold, lured by anything other than the fact that he is now free to go. He doesn't need a lure. He can go wherever he wants to go. So when you come to the Bacchae, please be attentive to what you're reading. Establish a mythic base. Establish a sense of meaning. And try to be aware of that while you're working with the haiku. Now I'm going to collect the haiku that you have, and I'll try and make copies so that everybody will have a sheaf of these for next week. Let me give you one last poem by Kandinsky. This also from Sounds. And we'll end with this. This is entitled Different. Once there was a big three, white on dark brown. Its top curve was exactly the same size as the bottom one. At least that's what many people thought. And yet, the top one was just a little bit bigger than the bottom one. This three always looked to the left, never to the right. And it also looked down a little bit, since the number only seemed to stand straight up. In reality, which wasn't easy to see, the top leaned just a little bit to the left. So the big white three always looked to the left and just a tiny bit down. But then again, maybe it was different. Thank you.